Hi and welcome to the Prodcast, your fix for everything innovative in advertising and production. I'm Pat Murphy and I've been working in this industry for more than 35 years now. I've seen a lot of changes, but know there's plenty more around the corner. Each episode on the podcast, you'll get to hear from one of the movers and shakers who are shaping the world of advertising for the future. And we'll dive into some of the key challenges facing our sector today and how we're best placed to overcome them. Today, we're talking to David Weldon, a legend and one of the most revered leaders in our industry. David is the president of the WFA, the World Federation of Advertisers. David has one of those careers that makes us all look like we've been on cruise control. He started at Saatchi and then went on to senior roles at WCRS, Lowe, BBDO and WPP, and then moved to global brand positions at Coca-Cola, Vodafone, Barclays and RBS. In March 2025, he was appointed president of the WFA for the second time and later named President Emeritus. Along the way, he picked up an OBE and Lifetime Achievement Award from The Drum, which is probably a decent way to say that he actually knows what he's doing. David, it was good to see you recently. Thanks for coming on to my podcast.
Well, this is Pat. Great to see you, and thanks so much for having me. And I always get slightly embarrassed about those kind of introductions because it just happened.
But the thing is, you're not exactly slowing down either, are you?
No. I mean, I think the it's interesting. I think I told you when we chatted, I first went into what they call retirement with immaculate timing in March 2020, just as COVID kicked in. And that ruined all the plans. But I always say to people, I'm not retired, I'm semi-retired, because I think we need to keep our brains engaged to do whatever we can to push back the inevitability of this final chapter coming to an end. But, you know, when people say things like you're president emeritus, I always say, yeah, I know it sounds like I'm dead, doesn't it? But I'm not yet. So I'm still at it and actually nicely back in control of my time, which gives me more time to read about stuff, look at stuff and try and understand what the hell is going on in our world, because an awful lot is going on.
There definitely is. It sounds like you're having a lot of fun still as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the fundamental agreement. You know, whoever first said it, and I, you know, you and I share such in common. And I think first person I ever heard say it was Roy Warman, who said advertising is the most fun you can have with your clothes on.
You're right. We did both start at Saatchi, and there was no better place to get a kind of grounding. I remember walking up those steps every day, and it was engraved in the top of the steps. So, you know, nothing is impossible. What an amazing place to start your career, I guess.
Well, it was, and for many reasons, such fond memories, because it was a meritocracy first and foremost. So if you were good, you were progressed. And if you cared about what they cared about, and what they cared about was great creativity that worked. And I love creativity in and of itself, but advertising that works is a really, really important thing to be involved in. And, you know, as we both know, Saatchi's at the time was brilliant because up one end of the corridor, there was great work being done. And at the other end of the corridor, there was a lot of money being made. Now, in both cases, it was work that worked, but they were happy to be somewhat chameleon about it as well. But I loved it. I learned so much. And actually, if you look at the, you know, when we met each other, the memories we have from that time, the people we could talk about, it's astonishing. Actually, it was an astonishing time.
It was definitely probably one of the best places I've worked to date. Also, one of the craziest places I think I've ever worked. There's plenty of stories, probably none of which we can recount on this podcast, but maybe on another day over a drink.
Yeah. But I mean, there was truth, nevertheless, in those words over the door. You know, it instilled the belief that everything was possible and you could do anything. Now, sometimes that anything required more money than sense, but, you know, if you wanted to get a poster campaign up in London tomorrow, you know, the place to go was Saatchi & Saatchi because they would find a way to do it. Not all agencies had that unswerving belief in getting stuff done.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. You once called yourself an accidental careerist, which seems rather modest considering your amazing career, David. Which moments felt accidental for you?
Oh, that's a fun, my word, you've done your homework. I think that was the first time I was interviewed by Campaign when I got my Low Howard Spink job. I mean, I think the thing that I was very clear about is I wanted to get into advertising. And I got to that clarity late, compared to others. I was probably 26, 27. You know, I'd been, I went to Kent University. I got a 2-2, a kind of disgrace to the education system that they gave me the degree, actually, given the lack of effort I put in. And then I became an English teacher, wandered around the world. And when I wanted to get into a proper job, it was advertising I chose. Now, the difficult bit was the kind of the year and a half it took me to get in. But, you know, I actually got in and started at Saatchi, and, you know, where better to have started. Everything that happened after that basically involved me having to say no or yes at the right time is the way I would define that looking back. So I never had a plan beyond that one. I never thought, oh, I want to do this, I want to do that. And I seemed to do a good enough job for somebody to turn up and offer me another one. And on the whole, I made the correct choices. I made one disastrous one, but that was entirely my fault, not the fault of the people that hired me. So that's where the accidental careers came from.
I think we have a few other things in common, as well as Kent University, by the way, which I've only just discovered from you. And I did fine art at Kent University, so it was great fun. I enjoyed that. And like you, spend a lot of time trying to get into advertising. It was the one thing I wanted to do as well as radio. And I'd been doing radio up until that point, and then I had to resort to desperate measures to get my first job in advertising. And I think I managed to get in to see Don White, who was the creative director at McCann Erickson at that time. A very colourful character, if you know him. But it was an interesting first experience. And eventually I got my job at Saatchi & Saatchi through chatting to Jeff Stark and Paul Arden and people like that. So I had the bestest time ever.
Good.
So you started in advertising and then went on to brand side. And I was at Procter & Gamble, and you were talking earlier to me about the differences between people who haven't worked client side and have worked client side. What did you really only understand about marketing once you sat inside the business rather than advising it?
Another great question. I mean, my first client job found me going to live in Atlanta to be the worldwide head of advertising for the Coca-Cola company. And my early experience of sitting in agency meetings, often my brain was going, Jesus, I used to say shit like that. And without any understanding of what was going on inside the company. Now, not surprisingly, I'll forgive myself for the thought of, you know, when I got that job, I was very excited. And I thought, obviously, Coca-Cola is only about advertising. And the first humbling experience was to spend the first 6 weeks of my career happened to coincide with the annual presentation of each country's business plan to the CEO, the CFO, and the CMO, who was my boss, Sergio Zeman. There were only six other people in the room, and there were Sergio's direct reports because we were a newly formed team and we weren't allowed to ask any questions or say anything. We just watched. So I'm sitting there going, great, can't wait to hear them talk about advertising. Nobody mentioned advertising once. Now, on the outside, you know, the agencies I were in, everybody thought it was only advertising. And this is not to say advertising wasn't a hugely important part of Coke at the time and still is today. But there's a lot more to business than just the advertising bit. Now, to your bigger question of marketing, you know, I also met some absolute geniuses. I won't set about naming them because I'll inevitably forget somebody. But some of the talent there, and I was privileged to be involved in hiring. We wanted to hire 500 new marketing people around the world. This is one of Sergio's things. And we traveled around the world interviewing people. And when I look at the greats of marketing over the time, most of them are people that got hired by Coke at that time. And the geniuses that could come up with, how are we going to get the pricing right here? How are we going to deal with the Pepsi problem in the Middle East, et cetera? You know, often underrated and totally not really understood by agencies. Now, I'm exaggerating to make the point because, of course, some agencies are better than others at that. But it was an absolute humbling experience to go, crikey, you know, I thought I knew about all this stuff. So you know, the one thing I do know the older I get is I'm happy to go, I don't know, and I'll have an opinion on stuff. But, you know, we're always learning. That's the good news. And my word, there's always a lot to learn.
I think that was the same experience as I had when I went to P&G. And I went as kind of a slightly cocky younger producer, and thought I knew everything at the time. Then I arrived inside the P&G organization and realized that there was a lot of very bright, talented people. So I felt somewhat humbled very quickly by being part of that organization, which, you know, obviously said, everyone says it's the kind of Harvard of advertising, that you get your greatest training at Procter & Gamble, and I did. So I thought, you know, what an amazing place to be. And then that made me a better person in production when I came out back into the advertising world again.
Yeah, I think I always ended up hiring people to be in the kind of communications team that had worked in agencies when I could, because that understanding of what's happening on the other side of the fence is really crucial. And it's a kind of, the mutuality of it is a good thing. I mean, I was given the challenge by Sergio, it's September 93. He said, look, in March next year, I've got an analyst meeting ahead of our results, and I want to show great celluloid, because that's what we used to say in those days, for, you know, every single brand we've got, and your job is to get it. Off you go. and it was an amazing task, but I didn't have enough people. So I came up with the idea, when I'd observed in myself this lack of understanding, I got interns from agencies for two reasons. So they could come and see what actually happened inside the company. They could then go back to their agency and learn. And also I could get some great people working with me. Michelle McKettrick, for instance, was one of those people from McCann, Seattle, and these days a very good friend, latterly chief customer officer of Primark. So I got to work with great people. They got to help, but they took the learning back. And I think, you know, I see that in many, many successful relationships, the understanding of how both sides work is pretty crucial, especially the tougher times get. And they do appear to be getting tougher and tougher.
So you were working at the banks as well. You worked at RBS for a time. Was that around the time when, you know, things were going awry back in 2008?
No, I joined RBS as part of what Ross McEwan, my boss, the CEO, described as the cleanup team in 2015. And I had a 5-year stint there where I was on the exco. And actually there, and my parting gift was to get rid of that brand that had long been dead before I got there, RBS, and get the group renamed as NatWest. And nice to see them flourishing meanwhile. But, you know, that was also humbling, because, you know, I was very well aware that we were owned by everybody. Fundamentally state-owned bank that got into a crisis of its own making and had never really said sorry for doing that. So one of the things with Ross is, you know, who was a brilliant CEO, I used to say to him, you've got to go out there and apologize for this. I know it's not your fault, but, you know, got big shoulders, you got to do it. And we paid all the fines and cleaned up all the reputation, and on we went. And actually, that was a really, really great experience on many levels. But, you know, I'm not sure that banks, and I don't want to talk about NatWest, have learned the lessons of 2008 fully, in that, you know, I found banking to be an extractive business. The same, money makes the world go round is one truth. Nothing happens without banks doing things the right way.
Of course.
But equally, if you look at the disproportionate amount of money that is taken out of the system by the very people that are making it, something's not right.
Last week, we had our 20th anniversary at Murphy Cobb, and one of the words that kept on cropping up was the word trust.
Yeah.
In that time when you were part of the cleanup crew, as you say, in the bank, how do you go about doing that when the public's stop giving you the benefit of the doubt?
Well, the interesting thing, let me start by talking about the fact that RBS was an internal construct. The Royal Bank of Scotland is the bank that RBS was born out of. And ironically, what the data showed is the customers of the Royal Bank of Scotland, first of all, called it the Royal Bank. They didn't call it RBS. And secondly, were pretty proud of being customers of the Royal Bank and understood what had happened. And even though the trust had gone, you know, that was quite straightforward to rebuild by focusing again on the Royal Bank itself. So, you know, we separate. So somebody had decided at the time that it would be much better to, for the reasons of production, to do everything once and then just stick a different logo on the end. So if you were watching Sky Sports, you know, you could see a NatWest mortgage ad. And if you flipped to watch Scottish TV, you'll see exactly the same film, this time with a Scottish accent and a logo at the end. And as I used to say to people, look, when you care so little about your business and your brands, customers can't help but think you might care so little about their money. So we rebuilt the brands primarily from the inside out. With humility, I think I like the soundbite I said to Ross one day, look, it's hubris that got us in this mess. It's humility that will get us out of it. So just got to do what we do properly, honestly, apologize for them that went before us and got it wrong, and do everything we can to get it right. And slowly but surely, the reputation returned. But as I said earlier, you know, the RBS was already a dead brand. It had been built for internal purposes of global branding, and the people that did that, name's too long, let's shorten it. It's obviously all under Fred Goodwin's aegis. And he did the things of, oh, let's sponsor Formula One, get this name all known around the world. Let's do this, let's do that. And did all, if you were building a global brand, it was the textbook stuff to do, and very well done in every regard, other than the business that went alongside it was not fit for purpose. And that's why the financial crash happened in the way it did. But, you know, if you look, you know, if you go and watch Big Short again, what a great film that was.
Great film.
You know, did anybody actually end up where they should have done as a result of all of this? Because I used to say,
not really,
to Ross, you know, what the public would like is some of this. They'd quite like to see that picture. That's how bad the trust was. But it got rebuilt slowly but surely.
Well, you must have done a good job, because I'm still with NatWest after all this time. So,
well, there you go. Yeah, I mean, I think, well, actually, let me just pick up on that. And I think what we did from a marketing perspective was focus fully on the customers and remembering what a big bank it was and how well we served the customers. Because in the day-to-day data, you could see that people were still there because they were happy. But the only internal debate we would have is, you know, and the guy who was running the retail bank would go, we've got incredibly loyal customers, to which I used to say, no, you're confusing inertia with loyalty. People are here because people don't change their banks. I mean, you have
That's
to do,
because right. yeah, yeah.
despite all attempts to make it easy, it's not as easy as it should be. And we should remember that first and foremost, and then give them reasons to be delighted to be our customers. But there, you know, the world of banking was a good place to learn every day again, but also a good place to apply the very principles I learned right back at the beginning. You know, do what you say you're going to do, communicate clearly, communicate engagingly, and always be open to learning and take feedback. And you won't usually get things that wrong. It's not rocket science we're talking about.
And you got your OBE, of course. Who gave that to you? Was it the Queen?
No, it was actually he who is now King, was Prince Charles at the time under COVID rules. And I always like to point out, I think it was Kevin Duncan, who I worked with at Lowe's, the great Kevin Duncan, who said to me, he said, my dad was given an OBE. And he said to me, he said, I'm going to say the same to you. Remember, what it stands for is other buggers' efforts.
Yeah. I've never heard that. That's great.
Which is entirely appropriate, because, you know, you get these things, you can't do anything in our business without working with great people and collaborating with them. And it was lovely to get the recognition. In fact, the very last thing the King said to me as he shook my hand and dismissed me is he actually said, isn't it nice to know that work like yours is recognized in this way? And I said, I couldn't be more honored, Your Highness, because I'd forgotten to say Your Highness. I'm supposed to do that and bow. But yeah, a very special moment. But as I say, courtesy off the back of all the people I've worked with, not just for me.
You say other buggers' efforts. First of all, I love that. But obviously that resonates with the phrase that you've coined before. It's a we thing, not a me thing, working yes. in advertising.
It is. I mean, my youngest son used to say to me, you'll forgive me for saying this, he said, Dad, shut the fuck up with that we thing. Because this is the time when, you know, we were doing too many calls like this and they could be overheard. But it's true, you know, because you'll remember maybe the early days at Saatchi's, I had a lot of clients who I would put in the swaggering, ego, arrogant box. And that's not a good, it's not a good way to behave, not a good way to be. So they were very keen on the me version of the world. So I learned pretty early, no, it's a wee thing. And you know that thing, you'll remember this, we used to say about account handlers, you'll do very well as long as you stick your chin out and allow somebody to thwack you if something goes wrong. And if something goes right, if you're happy to stand in the background and watch other people get the credit, you'll be fine. And I think that's right, because it is a team game. You know, I love the creative people in our industry, and they need looking after and cosseting in a special way because they're special people. You know, both of us can probably write a good ad. I think I can write a good ad. Can I write a great one? No. And I'm totally in awe of the people that can. But also, I think that means that they should be respectful of it. It is a team game. Nothing happens without great people making it work.
Let's move on to, like, this is the kind of hot topic, isn't it? AI. Do you think that in this new world of AI and other emerging technologies, we can still find outstanding breakout big ideas as much as we used to be able to do?
It's a fantastic question, Pat. Yes, I do, because I believe in the power of human creativity. I know you've had the great Sir John Hegarty on this podcast before, and he talks very eloquently about each technology as it's arrived and the threat that it had to, you know, printing way back when and so on. And here we are with another technology appears to be a threat, but remember, it's just a tool to help us be better at what we do. And I think that's true. And this is the first time, though, in my career, I actually look and go, whoa, hang on a minute. Because I get asked to talk about new marketing quite a lot. And what I talk about is, look, that's the wrong question, because there's nothing new about marketing. It's what it's always been. What's new is the speed of the feedback loop, the technologies available, etc. And, you know, when we used to say to clients that Taylor thing of you can have it, you can have two of these three things, you can have it fast, cheap, or good, what do you want? Now, what clients have every reason to expect is all three of them. And you can see that happening. Now, is that a threat to the big idea? No, absolutely not. And do brands need big ideas, big brand platforms as we talk about today? So I think the creative idea, when you're looking at it through a business lens, needs to be a brand platform. How can this help our business grow? How can it resonate in every way? Because, you know, I think, again, we touched on this. As you look at that thing that we grew up with, it's all about hearts and minds. You know, I've heard people talk about it's all about hearts and machines now. And you do indeed need to know how to get the algorithm to keep your brand reputation up where you want it, as well as the hearts and minds a bit. So you've got to be multi-skilled now. But I don't see it as a threat, because I'm an optimist, and a couple of your previous guests have talked to the same theme. You know, we have to believe that this is going to be great, and make it great. The danger, and you can see this absolutely at the moment, is nobody's talking enough about the jobs that are being lost as a consequence of it. And you know, if we forget that human side of it, then we're going to get in trouble. So, you know, at the same time as you and I were at an event where we were watching people say, oh yeah, but you know, blacksmiths, who cares? There used to be lots of blacksmiths, you know, world moved on, there aren't anymore. But you know, I don't think that it's not directly analogous. We've got a real threat to the business structure and capability, and people need to pay attention to that.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. We were talking just now about the advertising idea. When I trained at P&G, everything was about the advertising idea and how it can translate into every channel. But that was only when TV, radio, and print was around. Do you subscribe to that still today in a mega multi-channel environment?
I do. And in a way, you know, the brand I always like to highlight here, because this brand idea started as an advertising idea, it's MasterCard and Priceless, which was done by McCann Erickson a very long time ago. In fact, McCann Erickson would have been paid full commission at the time they came up. That's how long ago it was. And Priceless has delivered a remarkable brand platform for MasterCard. So, you know, they now deliver Priceless experiences. Let's use, you know, the McLaren team, which is now the MasterCard McLaren team. If you're a MasterCard customer, you can get never had before experiences through that sponsorship, and the brand enables that. It's the same idea. They have taken the same idea and built on it and used it, and they use it across the entire business, and it's brilliant, and they are brilliant for doing that. my predecessor as president was indeed the CMO of MasterCard, Raja Rajamannar, and I asked him one day, I think I asked him in a podcast, I said, do you think you paid them fairly for what they delivered? And he talked very proudly about the equivalent commission rate today for the idea. Now, over time, I'm sure it would have happened, and this will touch on another theme, but yes, I do think, you know, brand platforms can work very well, and it's lovely to celebrate one that started only as an advertising idea, but is born out beyond that. And many I could name lots of brands that do the same thing.
Let's just touch on a bit more about production. We're seeing a lot of the big holding companies trying to kind of retain that part of the process, right? So we're seeing the Omnicoms and the WPP setting up their very, very big production arms. Your role in WPP, what's your view on that? Because it's having a massive impact on the rest of the production industry.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure they're doing the right thing, but they must do what they think they need to do. And let me only really talk about this from a client perspective at the beginning. You know, clients want brilliant ideas, brilliantly executed, at pace, and with for good value. That's always been done by human beings that you get to know, that get to understand your business, that are part of the team. And therefore, as soon as you disaggregate the team, I think that becomes more difficult. It also enables clients to go, oh, well, actually, I'm not sure. You know, I had these other people ringing me up about production. Maybe I'll talk to them. So I think, you know, it's going to cause clients to look at things in a way that they weren't necessarily doing. And I'm not sure that's been thought through. And this is before you get to the impact of AI. Now, if you look at the great production houses, they're flourishing, actually. And the reason they're flourishing is they still do a brilliant job and they've still got brilliant talent. And a lot of their talent is actually freelance, which is why they don't have this overhead problem. Because to be brutal about the holding companies, when they say they're downsizing and right-sizing, it's just because they never managed their cost base correctly. And they didn't have that against the income. And now they're doing that at the cost of human beings. It's not really thought through from a client lens. It's thought through from their lens. I think is a dangerous thing to do.
I definitely think it's about retention of revenue rather than starting with a blank sheet of paper and starting to design the thing from the ground up.
Yeah.
And also, I think that there's so much great talent out there. Every job requires something different. So you need to have access to the whole global landscape of creative vendors, in my personal opinion.
But Pat, you must have seen this change. If you go back to when you started and, you know, the business you've now built and where you are, the changes must be astonishing to behold.
Yeah. We've had to morph and adapt for all of the big changes. We've had numerous changes over the last 20 years in our business, or in the last 40 years since I've been in the advertising production business. And it's moving very, very quickly right now, faster now than it's ever moved before. The next few years, I can't predict where it's going to end up, but it's fascinating. I love the business, always have. I just love advertising. And I'm excited about the changes because I think the control now can be back in the hands of the clients. You know, the clients, I think, are moving more to wanting their own internal capability and building their own internal resource around some of this. And I think that part of that is driven through the conversation around trust we talked about earlier. You know, they want to be able to have more control over their outcomes.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, as you said, when you worked at P&G, you were an in-house producer. When I went to the Coca-Cola company, we had in-house producers. I hadn't seen that before. So the big companies could always do that. Now, any size company can do it because the costs have shifted. And correct. I think that's going to happen more. But the agencies that are flourishing are, on the whole, the independent ones. And they're the ones that have still got in-house producers and still build careful relationships with production companies and directors and manage to do all of that through good understanding of the importance of procurement on both sides of the fence. This is why I remain really optimistic for the business and for the output of it, actually.
I totally agree. What advice would you give to a young person now coming into the creative or production industry who's trying to do things slightly differently? What advice would you give them?
Well, I mean, I think that, first of all, you know, remember that we're all learning every day, and learn from the people around you, not just the screen in front of you. So, you know, I do think that, you know, what I loved about Charlotte Street is you could ask people questions and they didn't mind answering them. They'd take the time, and you could learn, and you could learn through experience, and it built it. So remember, you're always learning. Remember to be yourself and be passionate about what you want to do and why you want to do it. And as long as you've got the kind of clarity of I'm here because I love this business and I want to learn and get better at it, you know, you'll be fine. And my advice is believe in yourself and believe in what you do, and do not have fear in your soul.
I love that. That's fantastic. I totally embrace that wholeheartedly. David, what do you think distinguishes the best CMOs and brand leaders now from just merely busy ones?
I think the very best ones, and I get the privilege to talk to lots of them through the same vehicle we're doing here, podcasts, is the humble ones, the ones who know they're always learning, the ones who are empathetic leaders and good human beings, and the ones who are prepared to defend their work and their team's work and take it on the chin when it's necessary. And they're usually ego-free. They're increasingly, and this is also great to see, great women CMOs. And I don't remember seeing many of those when I started in the business, but that mix of focus, empathy, humanity, learning, but, you know, driven to get the job done. That's the mix that you need. And then absolutely the ability to hire the capability that you can't possibly have yourself. You could, because you can't know about everything and you can't pretend to, and it's perfectly all right to go, listen, I don't really understand that, but here's the good news, I've got somebody else who does. So, you know, build the right team that does it. And then I think, crucially, given the context we're talking about, is respect the external talent that you need to get your job done. And the very best ones are really, really good at that as well.
And this is the second time you've done this job. What's different this time around to the first time you were in that role?
Well, obviously, the reason I'm doing it, which I'll touch on,
because no one else wanted the gig.
Yeah, no. Everybody wanted the gig, but nobody could do it because of the overhanging legal case bought by Musk. And what's different is having to defend an organization that punches massively above its weight. Very few people, that is only here in the interest of protecting commercial free speech and to get people to learn from each other. And it's an astonishing organization, and clients are incredibly generous with their learning with each other. So what's different is A, the legal pressure, and I have to do this because nobody else could do it, because I don't work for a publicly quoted company anymore. But I'm a bit like their uncle as well. You know, I know the organization well, I know the people well, and I'm just there to make sure they thrive and survive. And thriving they are, and survive they undoubtedly will. But this, you know, I'll be back being emeritus this time next year, I think, and they can move on. But let's add a couple of serious things here. You know, the challenges that the macro economic environment is causing the industry are one thing. Then there's this other thing, which is AI, and all of these pressures come together at the same time. So I've never seen clients under as much pressure as they are. I've never seen clients under the pressure to deliver cost savings, you know, whatever you want to call it, and reorganize. Actually, a lot of that is driven by the apparent promise that AI can do it all. And ironically, the one data point I'll use is 2 years ago, when the procurement part of WFA were asked whether they saw AI as a threat. I think it was something like 8%. So, well, you know, a bit worried that might impact my job. Last year, that had gone up to over 30. And because most people that are in the numbers bits of businesses go, oh, crikey, AI is going to clean this up. So more pressure. But what I also see, and therefore I'd celebrate, is more collaboration, more people willing to work with each other, trying to do the right thing in the right way to get the best outcomes. And that's what makes the WFA great, and it always will. But it's a people thing too. So, sorry, Pablo, here, as in my son, it's a we thing, not a me thing.
Yeah, exactly. And you have some great people at the WFA. Yeah, I know Laura has just joined you as well recently. So, if someone remembers one thing about you and what you stood for in this industry, David, what would that be, do you think?
Ooh. Passion for creativity, I hope. Humility, I hope. And collaboration skills. And the thing I like to see is the number of people that I've worked with along the way that are now remarkably successful in their own right. I take immense pride in that. So trying to help talent develop, that's not one thing I know, but it's because it's a, as I've also said, another one of my sound bites is, you'll know I don't have a good answer if I go long. I'll think about that. I haven't done that. You know, what's the one thing I'd like to be remembered for? But I think it's passion for creativity, first and foremost.
Yeah, I think for me, it'd be just passion for everything in the business. I mean, and passion for the people as well. And one of the great things about being in this industry, certainly I feel like I've worked all this time, but it hasn't felt like a job.
Yeah,
it really has been. Maybe somebody might find me out one day that I've managed to blag my way through life and not be doing any, not doing any work in the traditional sense, I guess. But it's been a lot of fun. So, David, look, I've only got one more question really to ask you because the time has flown by on this podcast. That question we have to ask all of our guests since it's become a highlight. What is your favorite ad of all time?
Oh, crikey. Well, I'm going to go with one, and this is a lack of humility, I hasten to add. I think one of the ads that I was lucky to be involved in has had a remarkable impact for very little money, and it was for the Victoria and Albert Museum, an Ace Cafe with quite a nice museum attached, because that changed the way people thought about marketing cultural institutions. I had the great joy a couple of years ago sitting inside the Victoria and Albert Museum at a Marketing Group of Great Britain event when the current director said this institution's future direction was set the day that Saatchi & Saatchi gave us this genius of an idea. So that's my favorite. And I know it's not very humble to say that, but I like it because it shows the impact of passion for creativity. And you can make any business better with great ideas.
Great stuff. We'll get that up onto the podcast website as well. Thanks very much, David. It's been great chatting to you. I could go on for hours, and I'm sure we'll kind of next time we meet, we'll talk about some of those Charlotte Street stories.
Yeah, we will. And thank you for having me, Pat. Really enjoyed it. Could have gone on for hours too, and look forward to catching up again over a beer very soon.
Today we chatted to David Weldon, President of the World Federation of Advertisers, one of the most well-known and respected leaders in our industry. David has been redefining what it means to build brands in the modern world. To find out more about the podcast, please head to theprodcast.com where you'll find details on all my guests, links to their favorite ads, and full transcriptions of all the episodes. If you'd like to recommend someone for the podcast or have any comments, questions, or feedback, please email us at podcast@murphycobb.com. If you enjoy these conversations, I please urge you to subscribe and like at your favorite podcast platform. I'm Pat Murphy. Do come and connect with us on LinkedIn or Instagram, where all the links in the notes for this episode will be. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks again to David and to my production team at What Goes On Media. Thanks for listening. See you next time.